This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select at random. Any book from my comic collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 169th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at Police Action number 2 from Atlas Seaboard Comics, cover dated April 1975. But first, a little feedback. Tom Pianerice recently got caught up on the network's offerings and had some comments on some of those past episodes. Professor, I admit that I've been very lazy in listening to the Quarter Bin Podcast, letting episodes pile up until I got into serious debt. So let me apologize for my listening irresponsibility. I did, however, get completely caught up by listening to 10 episodes in the span of a week. And I can certainly say that they're worth the $2.50. You know, after that comment, Tom, the hard time I was about to give you, nah, all is forgiven. Tom said he won't go into specifics because he didn't want the email to be too crazy long, but here are some of his highlights. Brave and the Bold 130. While I never owned this issue, it sounded like one of those books that I could have owned as a little kid. There's multiple heroes and multiple villains, and the plot sounds about as complex as the Scooby-Doo Batman and Robin team-ups that I loved when I was in kindergarten. Yeah, I think that's about an accurate assessment of that plot. Impact Comics, Tom did spell it appropriately, with an exclamation point at the start of the word. I was 15, maybe a little outside DC's target demo when they released these in 1992. But I did buy the first issues of Legend of the Shield and The Comet, both of which I enjoyed, but not enough to continue reading. The Legend of the Shield looked enough like a Captain America-type character for me to be interested. Tom Lyle had drawn the Tim Drake Robin miniseries, and that's why The Comet appealed to me. But yes, the idea did flop, and the books were overordered, at least by my LCS, who was literally giving them away about 6 months into the line's run. DC has had a spotted history with imprints since the late 1980s. Vertigo was, of course, the standout, and they found moderate success with the Paradox Press line of original graphic novels. But then you have to think about all the stuff like Helix, All-Star, DC Focus, and Minx. They all seem to get the usual initial push and then flame out. I have to wonder what their benchmarks for success are, something that's probably a topic for an entire podcast episode, if you can tear yourself away from organizing your comic collection, that is. Hey, stop talking about my summer plans, Tom. Actually, I think that's a good point about the benchmarks for these new imprints. Are they the same as for the regular comics, or do they have different separate accounting goals? Are they new imprints under their own batch of overhead or fixed costs, or do they share those with the mainstream comics? Because unlike podcasting's Michael Bailey, I know that it all comes back to accounting. Or, as I think I told him once in a different context, as a quote, the answer to all of your questions is money. On to the war books that Luke Giaconetti and I did, Tom said. I was glad to see you covered some war books, and always appreciate hearing Luke talk about his love of the genre. I, of course, have a love for Marvel's The Nom, but have also grabbed the occasional Sergeant Rock or Weird War Tales out of the cheap bins. Luke generously sent me an extra copy of the Showcase Presents Enemy Ace trade years ago, and that quickly became another favorite. Of course it did. One thing that got me thinking was a comment that one of your listeners, I think it was Manuel Carmona, said, which was that Veterans Day has been more and more neglected over the years, It definitely has, and while I'm sure that loud and obnoxious pundits on both sides would have loud and obnoxious reasons for it, I wonder if the main cause is the way many employers have folded those non-major holidays into all-purpose paid time off. Offices don't close, and even some schools stay open so they can close on the day before Thanksgiving. At least, that tends to be the case where I am. Again, it's a much longer conversation to have that goes beyond what is an already long email. As always, love the show and can't wait to hear more. Best, Tom. Thank you so much for catching up, Tom, and then for feedbacking about those episodes. Really appreciate that. Specifically on last episode, the Sherlock Holmes episode, Chris Lydon said that it was elementary that he would enjoy the episode. Billy D from Magazines and Monsters said it was a good episode, despite his never having read any of the Doyle stories. But I enjoy the film adaptations, especially the Hammer version of Hound of the Baskervilles. Glad to hear the lovely Sutherlands on the show as well. Cheers. Now, Billy, I watched that Hammer adaptation sometime in 2020, and maybe it was all of the COVID effects, you know, the being locked in the house for so long, but man, that was a wild movie. That's all I can say. It was wild. I guess as a Hammer adaptation, that might be what you would expect. Sir Martin of Grey had some thoughts to share. As a Brit, I should have greater familiarity with Sherlock Holmes, but never got around to the books. I have seen an old Hound of the Baskervilles, and that was fun. I hope with fingers crossed that it was that Hammer version, even though it probably wasn't. And Mart says, and I have a bunch of DVDs I should open. Oh, and the TV series with Benedict Cumberbatch was incidental pleasure, but like Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who, it would too frequently disappear up its own smugness. Thank you for that perfect description of Moffat's tenure on Who and on Sherlock. All of which made hearing about this not quite a comic all the more interesting. It doesn't sound like my cup of tea, although I'm a big fan of the Dan Day art I've seen. Did you ever see the Master of Kung Fu Bleeding Black special he produced in the style of his late brother Gene, who had drawn the original Master of Kung Fu book? Martin came back later and corrected his comment, saying that the Kung Fu book was done by yet another brother, David Day, bringing to a total of three, David, Dan, and Gene, the number of Day brothers who worked in the comics field. On the more general topics of mysteries, Mart said that Steve and he love watching them on the telly. We try to find a Hallmark mystery for early Sunday evenings. Chronicle mysteries, wedding planner mysteries, Ruby Herring, Haley Dean, Martha's Vineyard mysteries. Aurora Tea Garden is our fave, although the flower shop mysteries have the best titles. Snipped in the Bud, Dearly Departed, Marvelous Stuff, with Brooke Shields to boot. I have not heard of Encyclopedia Brown, Mart says, but looking him up, he sounds like a decent chap. Mart also looked up Lancelot Link. I would have hated that show. We had a long-running UK kids program, Animal Magic, that had segments with an otherwise harmless chap named Johnny Morris giving amusing voices to zoo animals. Such cutesy horror. Oh, Mart, you are a delight. Thank you for your feedback, good chap. Luke Giaconetti said he enjoyed hearing about the illustrated prose format. Moonstone did some similar books with The Phantom, where it was text on one page and an illustration on the opposite page. They also did Wide Vision, OGNs, which were illustrated prose. And of course, always great to hear the Sutherlands, especially when discussing a mystery story. Laurel Mountainflower 1 from the Hunters podcast and from the HR department at Longbox Crusade World HQ commented that she also enjoyed the Dynamite version of Sherlock Holmes that Ruth and Darren mentioned. And Ed Moore from Teal Productions echoed comments that I made, well, that M made through me. As my two sons were born in the 90s, We spent a lot of time on PBS, and the Wishbone was a regular watch. Good times. Thank you, Ed. By the way, in chatting with M about this after that episode came out, we both recalled that the Wishbone board game wasn't half bad. Social media love for last episode came from Chris from Professor Frenzy. I think it's a show. Sir Luke and Gene Hendricks, both from the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Drew, from Comics for Fun and Profit, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Karen from Between the Pages, Manuel from Buy Indie Comics Day, Billy D from Into the Weird, Max Reads Comics, Johnny Gill 6, Dr. Ange, Spy Vinyl, Sir Iowa's Joe, Derek from The History of Comics on Film on YouTube, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Frank Esposito, Weasel Skull, Mike from Comics in the Golden Age, James Williams, Vic in Phoenix, and our listeners of the year and guests from that episode, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. Before we take our break and talk about the details of our issue for this episode, I want to actually talk briefly in a big picture sense about the comic, about this title, about the topic of the comic, because we have a distinct elephant in the room situation. We will be looking at a 1975 issue of Police Action. This is from the era where wherever you looked, TVs, movies, comics, policemen were always heroes. Even the ones, maybe especially the ones, who were on the edge. You know, ones who didn't follow procedures, who were a bit more trigger-happy and aggressive than their captains would appreciate. And sitting here in 2021, many people, many of you listeners, look at police officers more negatively, or at least more suspiciously, than we had in the past. Especially, of course, the last few years. And although comics aren't real life, but if they were, many of the fictional police officers of the era, including the ones in this comic that we'll be talking about later, they would face public scrutiny, to say the least, for their aggressive and trigger-happy ways. They'd face protests, legitimate public outrage, civil lawsuits, criminal charges in some cases, and rightly so. I recognize that this topic these days, it can be raw, it can be emotional, and anyone who just doesn't want to spend the next 20, 25, 30 minutes hearing about exaggerated policing from the 1970s, I totally understand that. You are free to jump off the episode during the promo break, no hard feelings. Consider this your content warning. And know that during that next segment, I will just be discussing the comic as it is. I don't plan to treat it any differently from any other comic because of the topic. So after this discussion that we're having right here, it just goes back to being a comic. And again, I know that that's not what some of you lovely listeners want from a podcast right now. And if you were doing this podcast about this comic, you definitely handle it differently, and I respect that completely. I do hope if you choose to disappear for the rest of this episode that you will come back next time when we move in a distinctly science fiction direction. But again, if you choose to leave now, if you choose to stay, we're good. You do you, as always, all are welcome. So that gives you about 45 seconds to decide if you want to keep listening, because after the promo, we are digging into Police Action number 2.
My name is Jesse, a Trekkie. A radiation wave hit and I got shot through a wormhole. And now I'm on some distant corner of the galaxy on a podcast, an index show about a strange science fiction series. Help me, please. Is there anybody out there who can hear me? I'm co-hosting with an insane Farscape fan. I'm doing everything I can. I'm just looking for a way home.
What the Frell, a Farscape podcast. Available only on the Council of Geeks Podcast Network.
And we're back. To those of you who stayed, I strongly encourage you to have the same attitude and approach that I have about those who have left during the break. And that is no hard feelings. Police Action number 2 at a cover price of 25 cents, meaning I got this issue at its exact cover price. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, to be honest. The cover, by Larry Lieber and Frank Giacoya, shows a bearded dude holding a woman hostage, firing a weapon at a man who is jumping right at the kidnapper, and that guy's holding a gun too. The kidnapper is saying, "Come and get it, Lomax. First I waste you, then the chick." Exciting scene, and spoilers, this is pretty reflective of what happens in the lead story. We are promised all new, no reprint, which is important actually because this is a revival of a title from the 50s, but more about that later. We have 2 10-page stories in here, so we will treat them equally. This is the way that all 3 of the issues of this title worked, a lead story, a cover story, featuring Lomax, NYPD, and a backup feature starring Luke Malone, Manhunter. So first up is Taxi 2147 is Missing, edited by Larry Lieber, and yes, that is the first credit listed. This was written by Gary Friedrich, with art by Mike Sikowski and Al Williams. The part of Lomax will be played by Sir Luke Giaconetti. We start inside an unmarked NYPD car. Lomax and his partner McBride are counting the hours till the end of their shift when they get word that a taxi has been hijacked. And no heroics, Lomax. We can't throw those hostages' lives down the drain, no matter how much money it costs. The cab and its 3 passengers have been taken hostage by a bearded fellow who looks kind of like the guy on the cover. He's taken the cab straight to LaGuardia and parks the vehicle smack in the middle of the airport's main strip, which raises quite a lot of questions about pre-9/11 airport security. That means they can't move any planes until they move us. The hijacker demands $10 million and a plane to South America in exchange for the safe return of the hostages. But on the way over to the airport, Lomax has a mugging to break up first. Despite a warning shot, the punk runs away. But that doesn't bother Lomax. And with a blam, the potential mugger is brought down with a shot to the leg. He tells McBride to stay behind and clean this up.
"I'll go on to the airport alone. I gotta get a taxi cab unhijacked."
And as Lomax rushes towards LaGuardia, the hijacker is threatening to blow up the cab. "Listen to him! He means it!" one of the male hijackers yells out. The 3 hostages, 2 dudes and a lady, bicker among themselves. While the mayor and the police officer confer on the matter, Lomax arrives on the scene.
"This is Lieutenant Lomax. Open up that roadblock. I'm coming through."
Captain Stoddard is not happy to see Lomax. They bicker, and Lomax just ignores his orders.
"You just hide and watch while I clean up this mess for you."
On his own, Lomax moves in on the hijacker. Approaching the cab, he threatens to blow the hijacker's head off with a magnum if he does not surrender.
"I've got more sharpshooting medals than Annie Oakley."
The hijacker grabs the young woman from the back seat and uses her as a human shield. Lomax sees that he has no choice but to back off. The woman, however, takes matters into her own hands and throws an elbow to the head of the hijacker, momentarily dazing him. That is the opening that Lomax needs, and he quickly puts an end to the standoff. The commissioner and mayor swallow their pride and congratulate Lomax on another job well done. But his thoughts are elsewhere. He finds the woman, the hostage, and asks if she doesn't mind waiting while he cleans up some paperwork.
How about a nice quiet drink?
The end. So this brings us to Whatever Happened to Luke Malone, also edited by Larry Lieber, who also has his credit listed first. This one was written again by Gary Friedrich, with art this time from Mike Plug and Frank Springer. We start in the recent past. In a scene that speaks for itself, Lieutenant Luke Malone is waiting for orders from the captain. The First City Bank of San Francisco is under siege by 4 gunmen. Unless the police agree to let the criminals escape via airplane in the next 10 minutes, they will start killing the 20 hostages trapped inside. With time running out, Malone makes the decision that he can't wait any longer for guidance from his superiors. But before he acts, a colleague tells him his wife called HQ earlier in the day, looking for him. Something about a bank loan. This gives Malone a chance to reminisce about his wife, their ups and downs. Good woman, though. I sure look forward to getting home to her when this mess is over. He gives the order to rush the bank. They take out the first 2 bank robbers as they make their way into the back of the bank. Lieutenant Malone is shocked to find that his wife, Mary, is being held hostage by one of the gunmen. You remember, she called him something about a bank loan? Quick comment here. No, it isn't exactly the same setup as the first story, but it is very, very, very close to the same hostage scenario as the first story. Malone orders his men to hold their fire. The man comes around saying he'll let the wife go as soon as he's safe. You'll never be safe. Not as long as I've got breath left in my guts. Okay. I know I don't interrupt the synopses often, and this is the second time so far with this story. However, in my defense, the last line bears repeating. Not as long as I got breath left in my guts. And that is an awesome line. Makes sort of a weird sense, maybe, but it's not the common phrase. We'd say, breath left in my lungs or breath left in my body. But there's something about this gritty, street-level scenario where breath left in my guts, it just works. So, the hostage taker makes his way out of the bank with Malone's wife in tow, and a sharpshooter takes aim. And in the next 2 panels, we get a crack, a blam, another crack, and then a pow. The gunman lets out a un. But we also see from Mary Malone in a jagged word balloon. Oh! The police sniper's aim was true, and his shot struck and killed the bad guy. But not before that guy's gun went off. Mary! Mary! You killed her! You've killed my wife! And instead of ending, the nightmare begins. A devastated Luke Malone is thrown off the force and becomes an alcoholic. The man is hit rock bottom. Sometime later, his close friend from the force, Joe Wong, visits Malone and proceeds to beat some sense into him, sometimes using his words, sometimes using his fists. He tells the owner of Malone's favorite bar, I'll save the bum all right. Either that, or you'll have some exotic fish bait to sell in a week or two. Once Malone comes around, Wong tells him that the fourth gunman at the bank, the individual who planned and bankrolled the robbery, is still at large. Wong urges Malone to get a PI license and track down the individual. At that exact moment, because comics, gunfire rings out and Joe Wong is killed. Unfortunately, he was driving, and the car crashes into the guardrail as the assassin approaches. Malone, battered and bruised, he was in the passenger seat, is still alive, and he grabs Joe's gun and kills the gunman. Luke Malone, police lieutenant, is long gone. But Luke Malone, Manhunter, was born. The end. Although the bottom of the last panel says, much more dramatically, the beginning. All right. Let's actually talk a little about Atlas Comics, or Atlas Seaboard, as they were also known. Because some knowledge about the publisher, I think, is important for giving us context for examining this comic. As many of you know, Atlas Comics, as a publisher, has a long comics history. That name does. As a matter of fact, it was one of the names that Marvel Comics used between their time as Timely Comics and Marvel Comics. And the people involved with this line, with this Atlas revival in the mid-70s, included Martin Goodman, the man who hired Stan Lee, I believe, and Stan's brother, comics vet Larry Lieber. So I'll be honest, when I first heard about this line 10, 15 years ago, I made the assumption that it was related to Marvel, an imprint or a line, something like that. I did not realize until a few years later that it was Goodman and Lieber's disappointment with Marvel that led them to create this line of comics, to really directly compete and to use this name. Lieber had some name recognition, which I imagine is why his name is listed first in the credits as editor. Name recognition on his own history in comics, but certainly also name recognition based on his family connections. The line had a pretty big promotional blitz and a big opening line. One of the ways they attracted talent was by, in addition to having some veterans leading the company, was that they paid higher page rates than the industry average, and they also promised the return of original art to artists and author rights for original character creations. And with that strategy, they were able to attract some talent. Neil Adams, Steve Ditko, Russ Heath, John Severin, Alex Toth, and Wally Wood, and some hotshot youngsters like Rich Buckler and Howard Chaykin. And this sounds good, but it does increase production costs quite a bit, and it vastly increases the break-even point for the comics because you are spending more for their creation. So the number of issues that have to be sold for a title to be profitable go way up under this scenario. So during 1975, the company produced 26 titles. The most notable include Iron Jaw, Wolf the Barbarian, The Scorpion, The Grim Ghost, Destructor, and Savage Combat Tales. But none of these got past 4 issues. Overall, the company produced 67 issues in its less than 1 year of existence. Which means, although the line was a pretty massive and quick failure, it does make these very collectible as a group of comics. This is a goal that can be achieved by a collector. There are only 67 issues, so go for it, because you all need another collecting goal. I know that. Okay, so enough about the company, enough about the publisher. Let's talk about this comic. Let's talk about Lomax and Luke Malone. So first up, the first story. Now, I did not watch a lot of cop shows during the 70s, but I have since watched a lot of cop shows from the 70s. And this is exactly what this first story is. That's exactly who Lomax is. He's the tough cop on the edge, the only man who can handle the dark and deadly streets of NYC circa 1975. It takes a tough man to tame a tough city. That's Lomax. In terms of the story, my favorite part was the 1.5-page digression to break up the mugging on the way to the airport. It's sort of an early application of the broken windows philosophy, perhaps. Or, you know, maybe it was just good community policing. But whatever it was, Lomax sees a little old lady getting mugged. And this will not stand. Now, from a storytelling perspective, I think this scene serves three purposes. First, frankly, it fills a couple pages in a story that is otherwise pretty straightforward. It also lets us get to know Lomax and his policing philosophy, which includes shooting a fleeing mugger in the leg, which for any other officer who did not have as many sharpshooting medals as Annie Oakley, would be a terrible idea. One way that policing has improved since the mid-70s is the introduction of a range of less lethal weapon options for police officers. Tasers, most famously, fit into this category, as do certain guns that fire small beanbags. When hit by one of those, it really hurts. It is going to leave a bruise, but it's probably going to get you to stop, and the officer can then arrest you. And also with, I guess, possibly a few very strange exceptions, it's not deadly force. But to Lomax, less lethal means shooting at the legs of a fleeing suspect, which, by the way, is almost impossible to do unless you're Lomax or Annie Oakley. You're trained to aim at the largest part of the body, the center of mass. That greatly reduces the chance of missing, and a bullet that misses its intended target then becomes a deadly projectile in terms of other nearby innocent civilians. So what Lomax did, very frowned upon. And I guess third, again, back to sort of the storytelling or narrative perspective, that scene gives Lomax a chance to legitimately ditch his partner, or to ditch his partner for a legitimate reason. Because he needs to be flying solo by the time he gets to the airport to take down the kidnapper. And like I hinted at in the synopsis, was there ever a time when you could drive directly from the highway onto the main runway of an airport? I don't think so. But, you know, any type of action story, action fiction, you know, you have to make allowances sometimes for storytelling shortcuts. So overall, this was actually a fairly straightforward story. It was enjoyable. Lomax certainly characterized in a, what we can say now, a very stereotypical way of the action cop hero of that era, but not a bad story. Now, in talking about the second story, I do have some headcanon about how these two stories came to be. Now, I know normally headcanon is what we as fans do in assembling various bits of the actual fictional works in a way that makes the most sense to us and the way that either fits together the most logically or is simply reflective of the way we want those stories and those characters to behave. But the headcanon that I have here is more about how these stories came to be. So this is headcanon, my imaginings of the editorial and story conferences. So I have no evidence, no reason to think this is how these stories with really similar setups came to be. But that's how headcanon works. It doesn't have to be true. It just has to work for you. So the way I imagine it is you've got Larry Lieber and Gary Frederick having a story conference about the comic, right? Editor and writer, tossing around scenarios for the stories. And the idea of a hostage situation came up. And I like to think that one of them pitched the idea of the hero cop saving the day. And the other one was thinking, you know, that's maybe too predictable, too common. And maybe a hostage should die and send the cop down a spiral. So in my world, they talk it out, they argued, but they just couldn't agree on how that story should end. So Lieber and Friedrich decide to do both stories. Lomax gets one version of the hostage story, the happier, more successful ending for the hostage standoff, and poor Luke Malone gets the other. I'm sure listeners, as smart as y'all are, can come up with other examples of an issue where the lead and the backup story had really similar setups, similar storylines, but ended radically different. But this is the only time off the top of my head that I can come up with this situation where you have, in essence, right, the same bones of the story, and they are taken to radically different ways. Again, there is no reason to think that that was intentional, but with all of my fandom, I so want that to be true. I want this to have been intentional. And as basic and standard, stereotypical as the Lomax story was for a 70s network cop TV show, maybe the Luke Malone was more of the dark 70s cop movie, perhaps, because it was intense. And a ton happened in it. I joked about that page and a half, two-page scene with the mugging as a way to pad out that story to get it to 10 pages. But the Malone story does not need this. I mean, we joke about this a lot. But it's really the case here. I could see this 10-page Luke Malone story being turned into a 4-issue mini these days, easily, or 5, maybe 6. And that's because there was so much action going on. There's also a lot of characterization going on, a lot of emotional ups and downs for the lead character going on. And it's in those cases, in those situations, where a little decompression would actually come in handy. Because Malone, he gets put through the ringer in this story, but it moves so fast that there really isn't enough time for the reader to be with Luke as he goes through the ringer. I was not as emotionally connected to the character and his situation as I could have been, as I think I should have been, as I think nowadays I would have been, because this would not have been stuffed into 10 pages into a 15-minute read. And all that is not to say that it wasn't good, that second story. It definitely was. And I really liked how the seeds were planted about the wife being a hostage. We start off, he's called to a bank hostage situation. And then a page or two later, we get word about Mrs. Malone saying she was heading to a bank to fill out some loan paperwork. And then a few pages after that, she's one of the hostages at the bank. Solid writing there. And I have to say, I did not see her death coming. I admit, I was expecting another hero cop story with the sharpshooter maybe winging the bad guy, Malone jumping in and saving the day, delivering some consequences, and he and his wife living happily ever after. Now, maybe I should have seen it coming, because there's a couple pages where he is very wistfully recalling his beautiful wife. And as soon as he said, man, I look forward to seeing her this evening, you knew, oh boy, she's not going to make it to this evening. But I didn't see that at the time, and maybe I was too busy wondering how two such similar-seeming stories got into the same issue. So this one, this second story, was definitely a change of pace, and a good origin story for the other great 1970s archetype, other than the hero cop, the hero private investigator. So Luke Malone, Manhunter, is born. Unfortunately, for only one more issue after this. The verdict on Police Action number 2. This is just about the most 70s comic that I've ever read. And to me, in this particular case, for sure, that ain't a bad thing. Two stories that seem very similar at the start. Premises that are extremely similar. But man, two stories that go totally different directions. And that makes this stand out. You know, with genre books, you often know what you're going to get. That's part of what makes them so popular, or at least it's what makes fans of each genre so loyal to that genre. Part of genre is the expectations game. But with this issue, with these two stories, that was not the case. So if you're interested in non-hero books, in police books, this one's not bad at all. Definitely a quarter bin deal. I hesitate to weigh in on the entirety of the Atlas Seaboard offerings, but if you see any of those books for cheap, at least give some thought about picking them up. And that wraps up our coverage of Police Action number 2, bringing episode 169 to a close. And next time, we're going to be getting our sci-fi on by spending our next two episodes covering an epic four-issue sci-fi series. By that, I mean a four-issue sci-fi series from Epic Comics. And we'll start that next episode by covering six from Sirius, 1 and 2, cover dated July and August 1984. If you have any questions or comments about these issues or the episode, Atlas Seaboard Comics, The Gritty New York City of the Mid-1970s, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin.
Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.